You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Guidepost. We have a real cool deal today. Super excited. You know us, most of the time we're getting after people, kind of telling the doom and gloom of fisheries and how y'all can be good advocates. And we got a little something different going on today, and I think y'all are going to enjoy it. So we have a couple of folks from the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. And if y'all are not from Connecticut, Connecticut DEEP, that's the acronym, is just like any state's Department of Natural Wildlife, Wildlife Department, Department of Fish and Wildlife. They just call it a little something in Connecticut. It's a little something different in Connecticut. So today we have two folks joining us. The first is Mason Trumbull. He's the Deputy Commissioner for the Environmental Conservation at the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. Mason comes to us with a very strong background in outdoor education and working to expand public access to the outdoors. And one of the reasons why Mason is on here is we've kind of identified him over time as a key leader to balance conservation with the economics importance of people like us, recreational fishing, guides, people that bring folks to the outdoors, and, the entire outdoor industry writ large. And Mason's got a big job. So, when you have his title, he oversees wildlife, fisheries, forestry, state parks. And really, some of the things that we're going to talk about today are some stuff that he's been real instrumental in being a positive influence on, like dam removal projects. We're obviously real big on that with all our forage fish, everything that likes to swim up a river to spawn. And again, fish passage restoration, where they can't remove a dam, they'll put fish ladders, other things in to where the fish can get around it. And the real, like, lights out, knock the leather off the ball reason why Mason and his other teammate is on here, I'll introduce in a second, is Connecticut actually has a focus on growing the recreational economy, which is, better business through conservation. It's our tagline. And I saw a bunch of stuff going on in Connecticut, and I was like, my goodness, this lines up exactly with us. I got to get these boys on here. So we're super excited to have Mason on. And we also have Jeff Shaw, who is the director of the Office of Outdoor Industry and Experiences. Now, look, y'all, I come from a different place, but I've never heard this title, and a title has never made me happier, been happier to read a title, because this is what we're all about. The Guides Association just believes that if the resource is healthy and there's abundant populations of fish, and obviously wildlife, they work on that too, but we're going to focus on fish. If there's abundant populations of fish, it not only makes everyone tremendously happier, but it also drives the economy. And that's not just us. That's not just fishing guides. That's sandwich shops, hotels, gas stations. It's the whole enchilada. That's what tourism is all about. So again, we're very excited to have Mason and Jeff on here, and we're going to focus on all the positive work happening in Connecticut. So that was a huge intro, guys, but thank y'all. Did I miss anything on the intro that y'all want to add to the audience or anything? Or, how's it going today, boys?
Hey, Tony, thanks so much for having us on. It's an honor. And no, you got it all. We'll try to keep the boring out of bureaucrat today for you. Excited to talk about what you have planned.
Okay. Jeff, I love your title. I feel like they should have one of you in every state agency, man. Is it a fun job, Jeff? Do you like what you do? It's got to be pretty cool, right?
I love it. And yeah, there's 20, almost 25 of me and other state offices. They're all a little different. They're all in different state agencies. They have different missions and different charges. But essentially, we're all in it together trying to grow our state's outdoor recreation economy, get more people outside, increase access to the outdoors, and have a lot of fun while doing it.
Yeah, I'm going to do my best not to beat up on anyone today. Obviously, you two guys are off the list. But I, you know, it, when I see all this good and I see your title and we know Mason a little bit, it just blows my mind that every state isn't focused on this, because it's like the goose that laid the golden egg, especially if you're a coastal state or you're, you know, 10,000 lake state or something like that. And it's like, my goodness, it's easier said than done. But God, if we just focused on this, it'd be like, you know, it's like a bunch of casinos in a state as far as like driving revenue. And it's pretty healthy. It's pretty healthy for people to be outdoors. There's a lot of other benefits to it. So if y'all don't mind, I'm just going to jump right the heck in. So Mason and Jeff, touched on Jeff a little bit, but just give the listeners kind of an overview of your role, like what your day to day is, so they can kind of meet you a little bit, and why recreational fishing is becoming such an important part of Connecticut's outdoor focus and economy. And I'll let either one of you, both of you, whatever. No, there are no rules on this, gentlemen.
Awesome. Well, I can jump in for starters. Thanks, Tony. You know, just to back up for a second, you said it really well in the intro, but we all know, as people who love the outdoors, you know, I grew up fishing, hunting, hiking. I grew up in rural Maine. So anytime I had, there wasn't a lot to do other than go outside. And so that's what I did growing up. And, you know, here I am in Connecticut, folks in Connecticut, you know, from Maine, my thoughts about Connecticut were, you know, it's the state you drove through. And then I moved here and I was like, wow, there is so much to do outside. And one of the things that's unique about Connecticut is we have some of the most accessible outdoor recreation, I think, in the country. So we have 142 state parks and forests squished into a very tiny state. We have the coastline, which, as you know, drives the fishing, charter boats, just canoeing, kayaking, beaches, the whole thing. And so we have a really good mix here. And the cool thing about Connecticut is, you know, maybe in other states you have to drive 3, 4, or 5 hours just to get to the thing, get to the mountains, get to the coast, whatever it is. Here in Connecticut, we really have it all. It's all within an hour drive or less. There's a stat that says there's a state park within 15 minutes of everyone in Connecticut. So it's really pretty cool. You know, as people who love the outdoors, we see the intrinsic value in an ocean full of fish and a beautiful sunset. We see the value there. But what I'm trying to bring as part of this office and as part of our focus is there's also a very strong economic argument that supports not just our outdoor recreation, but also our natural resources. And I think when people think natural resources, the first thing that pops into people's minds is, hey, coal, lumber, oil, right? Those extractive industries. And I think these offices and the outdoor economy here in Connecticut shows that a healthy ecosystem, a healthy environment, and access to that environment through boat launches, through parks, through trails, et cetera, is really there's a dollars and cents reason to have those things beyond just the intrinsic value of the resources themselves.
Now, man, yeah, thank you for that answer. And I know you know this, and I'm not, I'm bringing it up to shed more of a positive light, but you know, there's also, I don't want to get too hokey here, but there's also just like a personal growth and like mental health thing. Because I think the three of us on this podcast, like there are days when you're like, I just need to get outdoors. Like I just need to unplug for a second. And I think as a father, I'm always finding ways for my son to not be playing a computer game. And I mean, that's how kids interact these days with their friends and stuff. But man, does it make you feel good when they walk in and they're like, hey man, can we go fishing for a couple hours tomorrow morning? And you're like, man, this is it, right? And I think there's just study after study that shows that there's not there. I can't find anything negative about enhancing the outdoors, whether it's economics, personal growth, appreciation for our natural resources and our planet. I mean, I just think that's why it's so important that y'all are on here. And it's Jeff, like Mason, you're doing all this stuff, but Jeff's like laser focused on this one issue. So like what gets your heart pumping, Jeff, when you hear Mason talk like this, like, and you want to pop up and get to work on Monday and you're like, man, I'm excited to work on that. Like, what fires you up?
Yeah, well, I think it was just a really great framing of exactly just this. I mean, there's just the public health, like the wellness factor for just getting outside, getting in nature, is just overwhelmingly positive. And as Mason said, in a densely populated state with 110 state parks, another 32 state forests, there's a lot of places to do just that, to get that break, to make those connections, those memories with your family, your friends, make new community, you know, build new communities, try new things. I mean, that's what we're trying to do. We'll get into it a little bit in our Partnerships and Parks program, but we're trying to do new or expanded services, amenities, outdoor recreation experiences, so you don't have to leave the state. So you can go 15 minutes from your house and maybe try like a new activity, whether that's a water-based activity, fishing, whether that's a trail-based activity, biking, whatever the case may be. And we're in a really unique position to meet a lot of people where they're at. And again, we just looked at a lot of data, as you referenced. Certainly there's a lot of emerging data in the outdoor recreation and health space, but state park visitation data, it's stabilized pre-pandemic levels. The new Federal Bureau of Economic Analysis data shows that the outdoor recreation economy in Connecticut is growing for the second consecutive year.
Exciting.
That's what gets me up. Yeah. That's what gets me up in the morning and fired up.
Yeah. I mean, the impact that both of y'all can make, I don't think a study can, you know, properly quantify it, but the impact that you can make like 100 years from now, when there's somebody, you know, a kid that's 8 years, you know, 8 years old right now, and that guy's grandchildren love to bike, hunt, fish, hike, whatever, love the ocean because of some program that y'all initiated. I mean, it's quite the legacy. I'm not trying to be, again, too hokey or dramatic, but it's true. You know, I mean, that's what my guys, if you ask my consultants to a person why they do it, they'll get teary eyed and say they do it for their kids. Like why we're always fighting for fish and, you know, sustainable resources. They're doing it for the kids and their grandkids. They're not doing it for themselves. And I think that is just about the greatest thing, you know, that you could ever hope for in an employee and a friend, you know, whatever, that they're doing their work to benefit others, not themselves. What's that old saying that, like, you know, the great, great men plant trees whose shade they'll never enjoy. You know, there's an old one from the South. Great men plant trees whose shade they'll never enjoy. So thank y'all for what you do. So this is, now look, y'all, I have my own economist, Dr. Ben Meadows from University of Alabama, Birmingham. So I have to talk with Ben, and our conversations are pretty much like an episode of the Three Stooges, where it's like, you know, Mo slapping Curly, Larry hitting somebody in the back of the head. Like, I can't, it is so hard. It's like we talk a different language. So the question I'm about to ask you, you know, I'm not looking for an exact number, but, you know, I think we all know in our heart that healthy fisheries, you know, beautiful streams, whether it's a brook trout stream or some, like, you know, idyllic lake that's nestled in a, you know, little hollow in the mountains, we know that they have an unbelievable economic impact, whether it's for guides, tackle shops, marinas, coastal communities, little towns in the mountains of Connecticut. What kind of economic value do y'all see, like, as a goal from that strong recreational fishery in Connecticut? And, like, are there any specific things, like, goal-oriented that y'all are doing to support that? You know, like, what are the couple things that our people, and it may be some of the programs that y'all want to talk about, but, like, yeah, I mean, that's it. Like, What kind of economic value do y'all think fisheries bring to Connecticut, and how are y'all working to drive that?
Go ahead, Jeff. This is all you.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. I mean, it's just the boating and fishing industry, at least according to, I don't want to get too much into the data, but it's the biggest, you know, outdoor industry in Connecticut. So thank you and your listeners for all they're doing to get not only out on the water and have people have great experiences, but the people they're hiring, the people they're retaining, the people they're attracting to Connecticut, because it is a great place to live, work, and play. And I like to add outside. But beyond that, you know, I think that, you know, we're starting to really just embed all these different types of outdoor recreation activities in the work we do. So, you know, we're certainly promoting outdoor recreation opportunities, and a lot of that is water-based through our partners at the Connecticut Office of Outdoor or Statewide Marketing and Tourism, CT Visit. So there's lots of opportunity to promote what folks are doing and amplify what they're doing. Certainly there's opportunities within my office, and that, again, through this Partnerships and Parks Initiative, you know, we want to get more people outside and maybe into fishing, maybe into some of those activities you referenced. So how can we do that? We want to hear from the folks that the charter boat captains, we want to hear from the working waterfront to hear their ideas for how to do just that and what they can have the capacity to even do. I don't want to send 20,000 new people to you on a Saturday in July, do I? But maybe spread them out over the summer, and that's something that's doable. We certainly have education programming. State Parks does public outreach, and we have a saltwater fishing day. We have other days. But we want to hear from you, and we want to hear from your listeners as to what they think they could offer that would enhance people's experiences in the outdoors in Connecticut, and thereby helping grow their particular work and shedding light on their particular industry, because it is the biggest. Again, with all the economic growth we're seeing, you know, we want to support it. We want to be partners in supporting it.
You know, guys, one of the things, like when I give a talk, especially to like the younger generation, so I not specifically, it's not like ASGA says, hey, Tony, you got to be at this event. But if there's ever any like high schools or colleges that, you know, in the community that somehow found out what I do and asked me to come and give a talk, this is the first kind of thing that I say. I say, you know, do y'all know what GDP is? You know, and they'll, half of them shake their head, yes. And then I explain what GDP is. And I said, okay, so, you know, what, I'm going to list three things and list them in order for the country as a whole: farming, mining, recreational fishing, and boating. Put them in order of the thing that you think adds the most to our domestic product. And you see them and they're thinking, and, you know, brave kid raises his hand and he's like, farming, fishing, and mining. And then you get all this, but nobody ever says recreational boating and fishing. And then I say, recreational boating and fishing is bigger than mining and farming combined. And all their jaws like collectively drop, and then they don't believe me. And then I tell them to go to commerce.gov and look it up for themselves. And they're all like on their phones, like pecking away. And then they see that I'm right. And it's amazing. Like, you know, people like me haven't done a good enough job to promote all the positive aspects of this. And we're obviously going to focus on that a lot. So I got a couple other questions for y'all, and some of them are a little bit broad and some of them are a little bit specific. So I'm going to do a little bit of a broader one right now. I don't think a lot of listeners know about this, but there's something called the Confluence of States, and Connecticut recently joined the Confluence of States, and it's a national network. And with Connecticut joining this and this partnership, I think there's 22 states all told now. How do you think that's going to make a positive impact for the future of recreational fishing in the state of Connecticut? And also, you know, what the listeners probably don't know, but a little bit about the confluence of states too.
Sure, I could take this one. Yeah, no, I had the distinct honor to sign the Confluence Accords, which is the foundational principles, common principles of the Confluence of States. There's five, which are conservation, stewardship, public health and wellness, economic development, education, workforce, and education, and opportunity and experience. And that is all embedded in, again, getting more people outside and having good experiences and growing the outdoor recreation economy. And I think, again, being the 22nd state that's joining a movement that started in just 2013. So it's still a relatively young, growing movement. That just shows like half the country has thought about this, and they see it as a strategic investment and in time, resources to, again, grow the outdoor recreation economy, access and opportunities for more people or for the residents of their states. It's just going to be great access to more very like-minded, but also probably smarter people than I am. At least I'm going to be probably the point person in this coalition moving forward, learning what's working in their states, you know, and what has not worked in their states well, and really what the trends are, really what the projects are, what the return of investment is. And again, just bringing, again, more amplification to, again, this growing movement, which, again, we want to capture and build on the momentum, the growth we're already seeing. Joining this network of folks that have done this work, some for a very long time, will just push us along faster than we would on our own. So I'm really excited for it. I know there's going to be another gathering this fall that I'm excited to be a part of, putting that program together, and definitely want to embed more specific activity-based organizations, perhaps some of your listeners, into some of that work, because we're always looking for partners to talk, advance these messages, these conversations, and these discussions. Because at the end of the day, I want to hear that the work I'm doing is helping you and helping them. And again, obviously, helping the residents of our state get outside and stay outside.
So y'all don't know this, but after college, I lived in Connecticut for like a year and a couple months. I swear to you, I lived in Wethersfield, Connecticut. Is that where I lived? Yeah, I lived in, I think it was Wethersfield, Connecticut. And I lived there in like the mid-90s, late, like probably 95-ish, something like that. And that was when stripers came roaring back. And man, let me tell y'all, between the trout fishing and those pretty clear lakes and the striper fishing on the coast, because I didn't have a boat then. I was poor as Job's turkey, man. I didn't have two nickels to rub together. I think when I lived in Connecticut, I think I made like $1,261 a month. And after my rent and all the other stuff, I think I had I had a flexible spending account of about $38.14. So my broke ass was able to get out there and do all this stuff, and it wasn't far. None of it was far. That was the thing that kind of blew my mind. So my wife grew up in Jersey, and she has such a hard time when I talk about southern states because she thinks everything's an hour away. And I'm like, she's like, oh, well, if we go here, you know, your nephews can visit us. And I'm like, that's 12-hour drive. And she's like, well, it looks like it's right there. I'm like, it's 12 hours. You know, it doesn't register. And like Connecticut's this tiny little state. But I got to tell you, you know, out of all the places I lived in my life, I couldn't mean mouth Connecticut because I was just a kid. I didn't know any better. I had never lived like in the Northeast before. I never will again because I just don't like the cold. But it's nothing to do. No offense. But like, I look back at all the fish I caught when I lived there and all the different experiences that I had. And I couldn't really name another state that has like everything in such a small little powerful package that y'all have. And again, for, you know, just somebody, like I said, couldn't rub two nickels together, I didn't need a lot of money to do it. So, you know, that's a long time ago. That's 30 years ago, but I remember it fondly. And one of the things, you guys are going to love my segues on this stuff, So one of the things that is, and this is not relative to Connecticut. I mean, I think this is relative to pretty much every state from Virginia north. We have these useless dams everywhere. When I did more work locally in Maryland, we removed a series of dams on the Patapsco River. And you know, some of them were just flat out dangerous. I mean, they were just a hazard. Like people would go there and look pretty and they'd go to swim in it and get caught in an undercurrent from the dam. I mean, it was, some of them were nothing short of public hazards that needed to be removed. And it still was not easy to remove them. And, it was a series of dams. It wasn't just one. And y'all, the Patapsco River is the river that goes into Baltimore, right? So not exactly an idyllic stream rolling through the Connecticut mountains, right? I mean, this turns into a very urban thing. But I remember like if it was the fall when that last dam went down and they had to reroute the river around the work to remove the dam. And then they routed the river back on its original stream bed. And all that was in the fall. So the water's flowing the right way. The dams are out of the way. And, you know, there's that question in your head and you're like, man, I wonder if we did any good. Because it's the Patapsco, right? And I mean, dude, like a couple weeks, I think a week from now, they're having this swim Baltimore Harbor. And I'm just like, man, you ever see that six-eyed fish from The Simpsons? Like, we're not there yet. Like, I wouldn't do that. You know, I support anything, but like, I think y'all have kind of gone off the rails on this one. So maybe like right in the spring after that, it wasn't a year. It was the fall, it went down, the spring. And my buddy sent me a video of a school of owl wives swimming up the Patapsco. And I just about fell over that it happened so fast. And you're just like, my God, if we give nature a way, it's going to find a way, right? That's how nature works. Like if you just give it a chance. So y'all are doing a lot of awesome work with dam removal and fish passage. And I believe the Kennytown, am I pronouncing that right? I have a Southern, so I pronounce everything wrong.
You got it right.
Okay. Yeah. Everything I say above the Mason-Dixon line, I pronounce incorrectly, and people love to point it out. So can y'all give us an update on that? Because, you have so many fish that you have herring, you have shad, you have stripers. I saw, I hear tales of like salter brookies and you know, these crazy sea run brown trout that come back from nowhere. I'm not saying they're going to come back. I'm just saying y'all have a smorgasbord of weird and interesting stuff and also stuff that's important to the environment. So if y'all have an update on taking that down and what you hope to see once it's down, the listeners would love to hear that because that's super positive news for the resources.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you, Tony. And nice memory, by the way, on fish in Connecticut. So I'll give you a couple updates on dam removal here in Connecticut. I'll end with Kennytown, but I'll start with the Farmington. So the Farmington River is, have you heard of it?
I fished it.
You fished it. All right.
No, I don't know if y'all remember. You probably going to have to get somebody that retired and like give them a call wherever their little house is in Florida. But y'all used, I don't know if you still do it, but y'all had like brood stock trout and there was a river that y'all would stock them in, like when they kind of ran their course, when they weren't producing eggs as good anymore. And back in the mid 90s, you could go to this river and catch an honest to God, like over 10, 12 pound brood stock trout. So that was a big thing. And then I fished the Farmington and I think it was the Salmon River were the two that I fished. And y'all were putting salmon in the Salmon River. And I had never even heard of that, you know, coming from where I come from. And I was drifting a fly down the river and I set a hook. And this little silver fish that was like 14 inches long came out of the water like an exocet missile. And threw my nymph out of its mouth. And I was like, what in the shit was that? And the guy's like, I think it's one of them little salmon they're putting in there. He's like, it is the salmon river. And he's like, and you talk funny. And I was like, holy shit, that I just took a little mini, you know what I mean? I'm like, that's cool. So like, yeah, I got that background. That was a long-winded answer. But yeah, Mason, I fish the farming. Yeah.
Yeah. So some of the rivers you're talking about here. So the Farmington, I used to, because I just have two kids and I don't do anything other than trying to keep those two things alive right now. But before kids, I used to do a lot of fly fishing, and the Farmington, you know, I used to fly fish from Patagonia to Colorado. And it was funny because anywhere I was in the country where there was a good fly fishing community, I'd say Connecticut, and people would say, oh, the Farmington. And like, it's great to hear you fished it. It really is a unique river here in Connecticut. It's tailwater fishery, stays cold through the summer. Talked about catching fish on mouse patterns. That's a big thing on the Farmington, and people are getting, you know, brown trout north of 20 inches on a regular basis there. It's just an idyllic, beautiful, everything that you would imagine with fly fishing is there in the Farmington. So it's pretty cool. The Farmington does have some dams on it. Like I said, it's a tailwater fishery, but there's the Head of Tide Dam is Rainbow Dam. There's been some efforts from the environmental community to try to take that down. We are actively working with the dam owner to try to figure out a way to increase fish passage there. I will say we've removed some dams upstream of Rainbow Dam. So we've provided, like, we're trying to think about it holistically across the river system. So we've had a couple other dams that we've taken out upstream of Rainbow Dam, kind of downstream of the fly fishing area. And then another dam in Collinsville, which is very close to the fly fishing area where we've created a fish passage. So it's one of our, you know, premier rivers in the state, and one that we're actively thinking about and working towards making sure we have fish passages up and down the whole river. It's not there yet, but we've made some good progress, taking down a couple of dams over the last few years. The other one is Canadian Dam. That is a work in progress. However, I think all parties are working on bringing this dam down. I think it will come down, to be honest with you. But I will say it's challenging.
It's tough, man. You know, yeah.
You said earlier, I mean, when you put a dam in, you have all this, it stops all the water, right? And you have these big impoundments and all the water flows downstream and the sediment settles out of those impoundments, stacks up behind the dam. You know, thinking about everything that runs off into a river during a flood, right? So that all that sediment is actually a big problem when you're trying to take down
a dam. The dam's been there a while. I mean, you have legacy chemicals that, like, we don't even use anymore that are, you know, embedded under 10 feet of goop. And it is not just like, hey, man, guys, let's get some dynamite and get one of them Bugs Bunny detonators. And you know what I mean? Everybody stand back like that. I mean, it sounds cool and I'd certainly like to push the plunger on it, but it's not that simple, man. It's just not.
It's not that simple, but I think patience is the name of the game. And like you said, it's all about the long game. Once you give nature away, it really does bounce back relatively quickly. So I think we're making good progress there. We have a lot of folks in the agency and a lot of external partners working on that one. And I think we'll get there on Kennytown.
Yeah, Mason, I think the most important thing with all of this is you're just putting one foot in front of the other in the right direction. And it just... You know, when at my age, y'all are both considerably younger than me, and so is 80% of the world. But you start looking back on your life as you get older, and you kind of realize those things that you chipped away at for years and years and years, like somehow you accomplished them, and you kind of look back and you're like, how the heck did that happen? And something as profound as this, as these dam removal projects, kind of fall into that. It's like, you get caught up in it and you think you're not making progress and then one day you're going to be standing on that river, you know, looking at it, and that water's going to be flowing and that dam's gone. And you're like, holy moly, we did it, you know, and it's never coming back and it'll be like this forever. And that's to me, that's like profound lasting change. So, I'm with you, man. I understand it's not easy and people want it, you know, nobody understands delayed gratification anymore. You know, they're like, sometimes it takes a long time to get to a goal. How old are your kids, Mason? Are they little?
Yeah, they're 3 and 1. So they're keeping me pretty busy. They're awesome. I joke about keeping them alive, but they keep me on my toes. And we just did the, a lot of your constituents will know, the cheeky fly fishing tournament on the Cape. And my wife also loves to fly fish. We brought both kids with us, brought them right out on the salt flat with us, set up a little temporary shelter, and they spent the whole day with us out on the flat. So,
I mean, what a cool, you know, listen, man, I can't even talk about anything because, like, my son's fixing to go to college. He'll be a senior next year. I'll get choked up. Like, savor the flavor. Like, it goes by like in the blink of an eye, and you're just like, how did this happen? And like, the greatest days are in front of you. Like, my favorite time with my son was like when he was resilient enough to where I didn't have to keep him alive, you know, like 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, like where they fall and hit their head and you're like, you know, rub dirt on it. Let's go. Instead of like, oh Jesus, like the kid's going to have brain damage now. You know, like, what have I done? Tina's going to kill me. But yeah, like we were obviously there for the cheeky and, you know, I think that's fantastic that y'all were there. Part of that goes to support us splitting three ways between a couple other groups, and Ted and Cheeky been doing that for so long. And we're just really grateful that they support us. And I'm glad y'all got out there and got to enjoy it. So y'all are doing something else too. And it's called, and I don't know if I'm going to get these things confused, but I'm just going to throw them on the table together. And if I'm combining something that doesn't fit, break it apart. But you're doing a 20 by 26 initiative. And that to me is like another one of these things where I got to get these boys on here, because you're trying to become more efficient, especially around like permitting, dam removal, habitat projects. And I think that's 50% of the game is being efficient while you're doing it. And then the other thing was y'all developed a new wildlife action plan. And that's, I think, a 10-year thing from 25 to 35. So when I was kind of figuring out what I was going to talk to y'all about and the questions, and because, you know, I'll be honest, Jeff and Mason, like most of the time when we have a guest, we like know them really well. And it's like a goofy person like me. And I do no preparation. You know, I think last time I had Blaine on here, I wouldn't let him talk until he did a Chewbacca impersonation because he's spot on with the Chewbacca howl. So like we're a little sillier. I'm trying to be as professional as humanly possible on this. So when I was doing the research, I didn't know if the 20 by 26 was part or vice versa of the wildlife action plan. So if y'all want to kind of talk about these two things, because to me, when you take all this as a whole, it really shows the direction of Connecticut deep, and some state agencies are hot trash and y'all are being proactive about things and working towards efficiency and dam removal, and you're coming up with these 10-year plans and you're joining big groups of other states to share information. And I'm just, I don't know, man. Like, so wildlife action plan, 20 by 26, you know, take it away, both together, whichever one first, I don't care.
Yeah, I'll take them in order the way you gave them to us. So 20 by 26, this is our initiative across the agency of about 20 goals to achieve by the end of 2026. And, you know, one of them, I think that focuses, there's a couple that focus on, things that your members might be interested in, but one is focusing on our endangered species reviews. And I know we're working on getting some mapping. The legislature actually approved $5 million for us to really take a closer look at what endangered species we have in the state where they live, which will help our permitting programs that depend on this information. It also help our conservation programs as well. And of course there's, you know, that's all across plants, animals, fish, the whole deal. But going back to to dam removal. We have these permitting processes. They're in place for a reason. I came from the private sector where it's, change. I worked in marketing, so it's something new every single day. And then you do something, you get it done, and you move on to the next. And so going to state government was just a big shock for me. The thing I've learned is, like you said earlier, things take longer in state government. There's, when you work for a private company, you have one boss, one mission. When you work for the public, you have as many people as live in your state, and you have lots of different stakeholders. You have to try to pulling everyone together to make decisions just takes more time. But one of the things we're doing with 20 by 26 is streamlining the permitting for dam repair and removal. So to make those processes, if an organization like Save the Sound or an organization like American Rivers wants to take down a dam, there's a permitting process where we want to take down that dam. There's a permitting process we have to go through. And so to try to make it easier to make sure, we're doing the right things. We're thinking about the sediments and the safety aspects, but we're also able to do that in a quick, efficient manner. So it's a bureaucratic process. I don't know, how exciting that is. Certainly it's not as exciting as doing a Chewbacca imitation, but it is hopefully allowing a
I couldn't do it.
You give me a few beers on this podcast and I'll do a moose call for you, but I need a few beers first.
Hey man, that'll work. Yeah. So, please keep going. Yeah. No, bureaucracy. Look, man, I tell people all the time, fish policy is like, look, first of all, if I wanted to be popular, I'd sell ice cream cones. And second of all, fish policy is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And it ain't never going to go away. And people just need to accept that. They just need to accept it that, like, there's always going to be people like yourself, Mason, and like yourself, Jeff, that are needed to put these things in the forefront. And I one thing y'all aren't talking about, and understandably, you've done a ton of focus on the public and like how y'all respect their opinion and everything. But then there's the darker side, and it's the bureaucracy and who's the governor. And who got elected this year? And how's the state agency going to work with them? And are we going to get funded? And, all of these things that are just super difficult. And if people can kind of understand that when they get frustrated, like, why hadn't they removed that dam yet? And you're like, well, if you only knew, if you only knew, like, they're trying. It's just a lot more complicated than you think.
Yeah, I think that's actually one, I'm supposed to say this, but I can say this with a straight face. This is one of the areas where I feel pretty fortunate to be in this job at this time. I got hired right. So I started at Deep, coming from the private sector, no experience, right after COVID. Mm-hmm. And, every state was approaching it a little differently, but our governor was like, hey, we're going to open the fishing season early. And we're going to open state parks. We're going to keep the outdoors open and try to there's not very much to do, but the outdoors is one of those areas where, let's get people outdoors. And that's been kind of the tenor of the current administration. And I can't tell you how many times I've gone on a hike with the governor, I've gone skiing with the governor, just an avid outdoorsman. And that also extends to the legislature as well. Lots of folks in the legislature really enjoy, people live in Connecticut. There's a lot of outdoor access here. So people just, it helps when you can talk about some of these issues while you're on a hike, while you're fishing, et cetera. And when people have these shared experiences, it makes it a little bit easier to get stuff done.
Which sure is easy if the elected officials actually appreciate and participate in the outdoors. Boy, does that make stuff easier. And y'all are fortunate, man. I'm going to say something, and I know for a fact that this did not come out of the state agency. This did not come out of Deep, and I'm not even going to ask y'all to comment on it, but that catch and release striped bass legislation came out and it passed y'all's legislature, and we were really supportive of it. And this is why we 90% of the stuff that we do, this is why we do it. Because people act like idiots. And we can't have anything nice. And you know, people are complaining, you know, oh my God, you've ruined my life in North Carolina. I can't keep 100 Atlantic Bonito a day anymore, and I can only keep 5. Well, how could you do this to me? And I'm like, we exist because you're an idiot. Because who would keep 100 Bonito? And if you weren't an idiot, I wouldn't have to spend the better part of a year and a half of my life trying to get regulations in a state that's really not known for conservation. And if everyone could just behave themselves and be a little respectful, but oh no, you got to kill 100 fish a day that you can't even freeze. So now I got to spend my life, my time, trying to not shut the fishery down, but just get reasonable regulations. And then I'm the devil. Well, you know, here are my horns. I'm going to dance around now. So it was my understanding on those rivers that y'all turned into catch and release. I mean, it's not my understanding. I read the news articles. They were training, y'all, they were training labs to sniff out stripers in the woods because so much poaching's going on. And this is not a Connecticut Deep thing. This came from legislators. It was not pushed by Connecticut Deep. I talked to people at Connecticut Deep. They didn't have their fingerprints on it. Stuff can happen outside of a state agency. So if you're mad about it, hey, don't be mad at them. If you're happy about it, be happy about Connecticut.
Hey, look, I'm here to comment on it. It happened, and I think it, overall it's a good story. So you're right about the canines. So let me start with that. So part of my job also is overseeing our environmental conservation police. They're an awesome group. They do awesome work. Basically protecting our natural resources, and a huge part of what they do is obviously enforcing fishing rules. And so, yeah, we have a couple canine officers on our team who do exactly what you say, Tony. They're trained to do search and rescue operations. They're also trained to identify fish. And thus, poachers often do this, right? They'll catch a fish if they're going to sell that fish. Instead of just like throwing in a bucket next to them, they're a little smarter than that, right? They'll go hide it somewhere so that when we come do our checks, like, yeah, no, I'm just here fishing. In reality, there's, you know, a bunch of striped bass hiding in the bushes. So what our dogs do is they'll go sniff out those striped bass. And so just, we've had the Housatonic River in Connecticut, the estuary where it dumps out into Long Island Sound, in the tidal area zone of that river, there's a striped bass population that overwinters there. So it doesn't head down towards you, down south, stays here in Connecticut all year long. It's great. It provides a recreational fishery for our folks. You can go out and catch striped bass every day of the year in Connecticut, which is pretty cool. But it's, people like deep striped bass. We have a lot of people in a very small area down here, so there's a good market for fish. I mean, I like striped bass. I'll eat a striped bass, legally caught, of course. And so our dogs will go in there, and just April 15th, we just got a big win. We sniffed out 6 stripers ranging from 20 to 22 inches, and were able to, you know, take the enforcement actions, write the tickets to the folks who got those fish. So having the dogs down there on the lower Housatonic has been really helpful with this particular fishery where we've seen just a big increase in poaching. And I think we got to a good place in the legislation. And kind of going back to what I said before, I was talking about the governor and how he's an avid outdoorsman. The chair of our environment committee loves to fish for striped bass. So just it makes my job easy when I can have these conversations with folks who kind of understand and who get it. And so the law that was passed is a couple of things, and I'll give you the details on it. First of all, it raised the fines. So that was a big one. I think previous, don't quote me on this, but I think the fines were under $100. I think they were $75, which really... Nowadays with inflation, it's not even an incentive. It doesn't stop people. So we raised the fines 3 tiers. First offense, $150. Second offense, $350. Third offense, $500. So putting some teeth on the fines were helpful. We also allowed the local municipalities to keep the fines. So those municipalities on the lower Housatonic River on both sides of the river, if those officers, municipal officers, go out and assist us with the enforcement, those towns keep the fines. We also, as you mentioned, December to March, that's a catch and release only area, so you can't keep any fish at all, which is helpful for us from an enforcement perspective. I also like that it still allows people who are trying to do the right thing or trying to go out and have a good day on the water, which here in Connecticut, as you mentioned, it was really cold. Last winter, we had people ice fishing for striped bass, which was pretty unique. Some winters is really warm. and it stays warm all winter, where you have those time, those opportunities to get out in the boat, you know, all winter long.
Warm so, for you. You're from Maine.
Yeah, that's true.
For me.
That's true. I have a.
Yeah.
I'm weird.
Yeah, dude. Warm for me is like when my skin crackles when I go outside. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's woof, man. So yeah, God, I don't miss that.
So anyways, yeah, I think overall we got to a good spot on the bill. I think we got a lot of widespread support. Yeah, there's some folks who might not like it, but I think generally speaking, most people in the conservation community support the bill, and I think we ended up in a pretty good spot with it.
So. Yeah, you know, it was, I watched it go through. We sent in our letters of support, made some phone calls, kind of did our normal thing. And I know that, you know, in talking with Justin Davis, you know, he's also a key player. I remember when he was, before he moved into his current role, when he was the fisheries director, you know, y'all were doing telemetry studies. You were looking at catch and release mortality. You did the science first. And I think that speaks volumes about the integrity of the agency. When, you know, it's like, do we even have a problem? Okay, the public's saying this, let's figure it out. So this wasn't some like willy-nilly thing that somebody got a wild hair and got legislation passed. You know, the state agency had listened to the people, identified the problem, executed good science, and then kind of had the understanding. And if this is a local resident population, you can't manage them the same way as you're managing the migratory population. You know, maybe they need to be treated a little bit different, this local population. And I mean, for me, for one, obviously we supported it. And it was one of those things that we actually considered a win, you know, and educated our members and advocates on it and kind of held it up, you know, held it up as a standard and said, look, we can win stuff. Yeah, because we lose a lot more than we win. So it was super encouraging for our people. And I think people really see Connecticut in a positive light. And so, like, I, you know, we're running short on time. I don't know if y'all have to jump, but I had a couple more just things. And, you know, one of the things that I always like when I have a little bit more of a professional podcast like this, one of the things that I like to do is to ask y'all, like, what can we do? My community that I represent to help DEEP accomplish your goals or to help y'all with information, you know, so y'all can be confident that, you know, you're making the best decisions for the resource. Like, what can my people, I got great people in Connecticut, and I personally have not done a good enough job at connecting them with y'all, with the leadership at DEEP. And I'm looking at all the awesome stuff you're doing, and I'm like, well, geez, man, we should be helping more. Like, part of my job is to look in the mirror. I love the people that I represent. Like family. I mean, they're just the best. At some point, y'all are gonna meet them face to face, and you'd be like, man, he was right. These are just salt of the earth, best dudes you ever want to meet. So, like, what can I do in my community to help y'all with your decision making and help y'all with your goals? What can I do to be better steward of Connecticut's resources?
Yeah, I can start, and I'll punt it to you, Jeff. I think it's important for us to have stakeholders, especially stakeholders from. We have across the spectrum, so conservation stakeholders, business stakeholders who are advocating for the same thing. And so often sometimes you see conservation and business stakeholders advocating for different things, right? But when you have the two coming together with shared goals, I think that is something that's pretty rare. And so people pay attention when they see that. And then you should talk to Jeff. We're trying to do some cool stuff with partnerships and parks. We have some opportunities. Just to give you all a sneak peek, we're hoping to, in the next few weeks, announce five new state parks where we're going to have opportunities to rent canoes, kayaks, paddleboards. So a cool opportunity in a state park that might not otherwise be there. So sneak peek, we'll be announcing that soon. And that's some of the stuff that Jeff is working on, and we're open to ideas. And so Jeff, maybe you can talk to a little bit about how folks can share some of their ideas with us on a formal level.
For sure. Thanks, Mason. Thanks for the question, Tony. Yeah, the Partnerships and Parks Initiative really is just a formal way of asking your audience, others, what their ideas are for new or expanded activities, services, amenities, outdoor recreation experiences in Connecticut, specifically in our state parks. But it could be beyond that, really. And yeah, you know, talk to me. I want to meet with as many people as I can. And that's been one of my goals so far in this new role. Outdoor Recreation Day at the Capitol. It was the inaugural event to raise awareness about Connecticut's growing outdoor recreation economy. And again, all of these different opportunities to get outside. And you don't have to go far to do it, as we've already talked about. But really, you know, how to do that, you know, send an email. There is a template, you know, just with some prompt questions about kind of where, when, how, but we want to hear from you. So if you have an idea how to get more people on the water, catching fish or attempting to catch fish, is just spending time talking with their friends and family, that's fine too. But obviously the gear can be, if you've never done it before, never ever, is we're also interested in Learn To programs. So if they're, you know, to get more people into it that may not have the gear, but have always wanted to try it. So that's something we can also kind of explore a partnership with at Deep for one of our events. I'm also going around the state. I went to the Connecticut Fishing and Outdoor Show in April. I was at the boat show and Hartford Boat Show, I think back in January. So again, just trying to meet the industry as much as possible and hear from them, what keeps them up at night, but also what are the opportunities? You know, what are customers looking for? You know, what are those messages to get more tourists to Connecticut to, make sure that more people are having a great time and thinking about Connecticut for that next, you know, great outdoor recreation experience.
Well, you know, I work with every state agency from Maine to Texas, or really Maine to Louisiana. Y'all should be super proud of what you do. And you should also be grateful because other state agencies working for them is career suicide. And it's a tangled nightmare of horror and a revolving door. And we're just super, super happy that, such a tiny state is such a powerhouse when it comes to seeing things like the outdoors and fisheries the right way. And we just look forward to doing stuff with y'all. I'd be remiss not to mention that, you know, you have an incredible tournament in Connecticut in October, the Tightline Slam that one of our officers runs. And we'd love to invite y'all to that. I'm not trying to put you on, this is not like a gotcha moment on a podcast, man. Like, I'd love to invite y'all to that. Me and one of my consultants fished it year before last, and we were in those Norwalk Islands. And it's just, you know, so funny, man, because like, it's just different strokes for different folks. And, you know, people use different flies and it's a fly fishing tournament. People use different flies. They do different things. And one of my best friends and my consultants, a guy named Blaine Chocolate, who's kind of I'm a little biased because we've been friends for 25 years, but I think he's the best fly tier in the world at this point with us. The guy's like a savant. And we were fishing with this fella. They teamed us up with this fella from Connecticut, real nice guy, family man. And me and Blaine get on the boat and the guy's like looking at our flies and looking at our rods. And he's like, I've never seen that before. You know, what is that? And we're like, oh, it's this thing called a jerk changer. And it looks like, it kind of looks like we walk the dog with it. And it looks like a finesse fish. And he's like, well, why you got two of them on there? And it's like, well, that's how we fish them. You know, it's like a donkey rig they call for, you know, spin fishing where they put a triple swivel on and they kind of scissor back and forth the flies. And he kind of looked at us like cockeyed and funny, but we took second place in the tournament. It wasn't so funny. You know, when he saw the stripers dump truck in those things. And he was like, can you send me some of those or something? And it was so pretty. And you have those big rocks in the water and you have this vegetation going back and forth in the current, and it's pretty clear water. And it was just wonderful to experience it. I had never fished the Norwalk Islands before, but that's usually like the second week in October, but I'll send you all the information, and the whole agency is more than welcome to come and see the community. It's really wonderful people. I will tell you that when Blaine lives in rural Virginia, like around Roanoke. I think Mason knows Blaine because he knows who I'm talking about. So Blaine, you know, kind of just fell off the turnip truck. He lives in like around Roanoke, Virginia. I live on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and we're both driving up in separate directions. And we're looking at our little maps on our cars. And I look down, I'm like, hey man, we're 45 minutes away. We're going to be there real soon. Like, let's go. Yeah, this place is supposed to have good pizza, man. Let's go get Connecticut pizza. It's supposed to be great. Let's go get some good pizza. And like 20 minutes later, he calls me. He's like, dude, I'm an hour and 20 minutes away now. And I look at my phone. I'm like, I'm an hour and 30. I'm like, did we make a wrong turn? And they're like, nope, this damn traffic. And the traffic just kept getting, I was getting closer, but further away. And I'm like, I think the space-time continuum has gone all cattywampus. Like, it's because, like, I'm getting closer, but it's further. And we couldn't wrap our heads around that. And then we were like, well, Jesus, man, we should probably leave, like, 3 hours early to go 5 miles that away to get to the tournament tomorrow. But we made it on time. But we love Connecticut, man, and I thank y'all for being on here. And just, we're going to stop the recording, but y'all just have to hang out for, like, 2 minutes afterwards. But thank you, Mason. Thank you, Jeff. We're super happy with everything that y'all are doing in Connecticut, and we're here to support you and make y'all successful. So thank y'all for being part of the podcast. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tony.
Thanks so much, Tony.